In this final part of our conversation, Gail explains why she tries to think like a singer when she plays. And we end our conversation by talking about her teaching concepts. So, well, you've done a lot of different things. You've played in orchestras. You've played chamber music. You've also, we haven't talked about it yet, been a soloist across the world. So let me ask you a couple of questions about this. What would you say is the difference in phrasing between singers, brass players, woodwind players, and string players? And that's one of the questions that is a difficult question to answer, maybe, but let me know what you think. And this would be probably speaking in generalities, but maybe it just sparks an idea.
Well, personally, what I try to do in my own playing is to do what a singer would do. If I had a great voice, and I've always said this, if I had a great, great, great voice, I wouldn't be playing the horn, because the literature is so much better in the voice. You know, all these phenomenal songs that they have, the Lieder and the operas and everything. So, and they also have diction and they have pronunciations. Why not try to match that? Envision what you would do if you were singing that and, oh, you have a comma. Well, maybe you have to make a phrase ending. Or there's a period or an exclamation point. And I think brass players are very visual, more visual than singers. Maybe that's a bad thing to say, but I think if we see on the page you've got a crescendo, you do it.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Why do you do it? Would a singer make a crescendo like that immediately, or does it go over a period of time? Same thing with levels of dynamics. I think we're very visual. And when you see a diminuendo, you do it. Well, maybe it's supposed to be over 20 bars, you know. But I think that's what I try to do. As a horn player, it's interesting. I've had people say, well, do you think you're a brass player? No. As a horn player, I think you have lots of hats. In the orchestral literature, in chamber music, in opera, you have to wear different hats. You may be secondary to the tenor in a great aria. And so you're playing a duet. So you have to be like a vocal person. You have to breathe when they might have to breathe instead of blow through something because you can. When you're playing in an orchestra, are you with the brass section or are you with the woodwinds? Or are you with the strings? You know? And I think that's the most fun part of playing horn, is that you get a chance to solo with all these different instruments. And I feel like that's your opportunity to have different expressions, you know, because at some point you may be in a brass trio. And so you have to play very differently. And then all of a sudden you're part of a woodwind quintet or you're doing a string quintet, you know. I think the more we can listen to great singers and how they articulate their words, we can imitate how they do that. And I think the more we can try to sing, no matter what we play, I think we're a better musician.
Do you know the name Emanuel Richter?
No.
He's co-solo trumpet with the Basel Symphony now, but he played for several years as solo trumpet with La Scala. And I was talking to him about that, and he said, of course, everybody who sings at La Scala is great, but he said the really outstanding singers, you know, the great above the great, he said, like, for example, the sopranos, if they would have, like, some vocal line that would go from, like, a note maybe in the middle register to the high register, even if it was forte, they would just back off a little bit when they went up, and I think the tendency is to give a little bit more as you go up, but he said they would just float the upper register. And I think that's basically sort of what you're talking about. And I remember talking about, for brass players, that would be like slurs. One summer at Summit Brass, you said that you'd been working for 6 months trying to make your slurs not clean because you wanted to be able to do a portamento like singers or like string players, because singers don't sing somewhere. They don't do a perfect slur if they're singing somewhere over the rainbow. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really analyze it, they it's like they do a portamento to get up to the top note.
Yeah, I think that's the same thing with great string players. And so you have to imitate that. I was so fortunate. I got to hear Renee Fleming over the years. And to hear the development of her voice has been pretty remarkable, that you keep changing, and it's okay to change. And I met her when she was probably 22, maybe 21, when she was singing for one of my to-be nannies here at Northwestern as a young student. And you could recognize then, holy mackerel, what a voice. But the development of maybe she sang the lighter soprano, and then it became a little bit more of the countess, you know, those kind of roles as her voice developed. And you hope you can imitate that as a brass player. And you can have different colors. I think thinking music in colors and not just dynamics is one of my favorite things to try to do, you know.
Have you read her book?
Renee Fleming's?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good. And it's not the typical biography, because it really talks about the stages she went through in terms of developing as a singer and adding different colors and different aspects to her voice, I guess. And she'd study with one person for something and then another person for something else.
That her, you know, her parents were both music teachers in Rochester, New York. When she did a master class over here one time, she was dressed very nicely, so she didn't do this, but she does Pilates, and she had a student get down and do a plank and sing.
Wow. Really? And sing at the same time?
Yeah, and that's the kind of, if you want to say support, which I hate to use that word because Mr. Jacobs hated to use the word support, but that is sort of the direction and the energy that she would describe as what you need to do before you sing. So I got a horn class and made them get down and do a plank the other day.
Okay. That's great. Okay.
And it was really interesting because some of them were shaking. And the minute they did it, I was like, what's your problem?
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's really good.
But it was very impressive to hear her, you know, describe how that inner core, inner strength. So you have the freedom to do things. And I think that's it.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Not that you have to use it all the time.
No.
You know, no. It's like you follow baseball a lot, and they talk about certain pitchers that when they, like Tom Seaver, I remember Vince Scully saying when he first joined the league, he was a thrower and he evolved into a pitcher, meaning that he had power at the beginning. Later he had power, but he didn't use it all the time. You know, he was a much more complete pitcher.
Right.
So one thing that we haven't discussed, we have talked about phrasing and colors a lot. But one additional thing you do is you play natural horn, and you've done that for quite a while, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately, the natural horn stuff that I was doing dried up, but I refer to it probably daily in my teaching. I just, like this morning, did you ever try that on the natural horn? No. Well, let's try it on the natural horn, because I think it gives you something to add to what you're already doing. Whether you ever perform in public. And I remember many times Norman Schweikert and I'd be standing backstage thinking, what the heck are we doing this for? You know, but it was a great opportunity to add those kind of colors and that articulation. There's different articulations because it'll bark back at you. But also to learn about phrasing that might have been possible or not, especially when you're studying the classical era, Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn. I had them all do it today, you know. So it's interesting. It's for me, it's at this point when people have never attempted to play any natural horn. It boggles my mind because we have all the crooks without moving anything. We have them all right here. So it's easy to demonstrate. But then, you know, I've played the Ligeti Horn Trio. And I don't know how, if you've seen the music for that, Tony, but it's, if you've never seen it and you listen to it, you think, holy mackerel, the horn player is really playing out of tune. No, the whole second movement is you go through all the crooks. So from this to here, you're playing E flat horn, and then you go to G horn, and you're supposed to use those fingerings of the natural horn on your horn. And so you're supposed to not adjust when certain partials are out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I did that, I was like, man, am I glad I played natural horn to know how to get into those notes without using vowels.
I think one of the most beautiful notes is on the Britten. Mm-hmm. I just forgot the name of it.
Serenade for strings and horns.
Serenade, yes. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The opening, because there's one high note that's, I think it's sharp, and it sounds so beautiful there. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And if it was in tune, okay, it would sound fine. But having it be sharp just adds, yeah. I don't know, lots something of, really, really special.
Yeah, when I play that, I always play that on natural horn, you know, so people will know, oh, it's supposed to be out of tune.
Yeah,
because I've seen people get bad reviews when they've played it. And they didn't change.
Really?
They just played it on their double horn. And as they played it as a natural horn. And people, well, that person's just playing out of tune because they don't know.
So you would think critics should know that. But they,
you would think.
You would think.
Maybe that was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But what I like to do now is I like to play it on a natural horn. But then for the epilogue, it works great on my elp horn.
Really?
It's it's like exactly what you want to hear backstage. Poo, 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 you know, kind of that kind of color and the timing. It really works great.
You know, I live in a small dorf, a small village in just outside of Freiburg in Germany. And so we're right in the Black Forest and the mountains are right above us. And this was when we first got here, probably within the first couple of years, but it would be about once or twice a year, we'd wake up in the morning and somebody would be in the hills playing alp horn. And it was magnificent. It was just great.
Yeah, it's nothing like it. It's like, what, you know, the words to the Brahms First Symphony, you know, that da 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 dum, that. It's an alp horn call.
Right.
You know? Do you know the words to that?
No, I don't actually. I should.
Hof, hawk om den berg, high in the mountain.
Yeah.
Tief and tall, down in the valley.
Okay, in the valley. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Grüßisch dich.
Tief und tall, grüßisch dich. Okay. Uh huh.
Sending regards. And Brahms wrote on a note card to Clara Schumann, he wrote all this, and they said, Johannes Brahms.
Okay, that's good. Well, speaking of Brahms, have you played the Brahms Trio on natural horn?
In my studio, not in public.
And does that influence the way you play it on the modern horn?
Absolutely.
How so? In terms of
color, phrasing, and the slow movement. Da 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 da. There in the wood is a little house, and it's very, very moody. Da 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 da. And then the next phrase, you're secondary to the violin, and it's all kind of half stopped.
Which is better with the natural horn?
I kind of try to do it. Well, sure, I think it's really cool with the natural horn, but I try to do it with a little different hand position, trying to get that velvet kind of veiled quality. Not to change the pitch, but just to change the color. Because you can.
Yeah, and I think you really need to think about it. But that's, yeah. I think that's, to me, that's one of the really great things about wind instruments, especially brass instruments, is you can have a myriad of different colors that you can use.
Changing the vowels and whatever you want to just to accommodate those kind of sounds and colors. Yeah. And you did a lecture about that.
Did I?
Yeah. Kiri, really? Kiri, ki.
Oh, well, that's Baroque articulation.
But still, that's changing the vowels and stuff like that and consonants. And you can use that as if you're reading a vocal score and you see the different, I don't want to say diction or something, you can imitate that in your articulation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the final thing that I'd like to cover with you is your teaching, because you're also a teacher, Professor Gail Williams. And you've been at Northwestern for quite some time. And could you say that there are any general principles about your teaching that you try to convey to every student in addition to specifics for a particular student?
Oh, I would say probably talk about the use of air. thank you, Mr. Jacobs, more than anything, because I think people come in here and they're way too tight and they try to do things with tension. And because I've done a lot of Alexander technique and also another thing called Aston patterning, it's sort of similar. I want to make sure that my students are efficient. That's the terribly, terribly important to me, that they're efficient and they can hear the difference when they're not and when they're efficient and when all of a sudden something gets tight. And that's what I do all the time. Seems like that's what I'm constantly doing. Did you hear the difference? Can you observe what you're doing differently here for your tension? And, oh, maybe you're holding tension in your toes. You know, let's see what you're doing here, you know? And basically thinking about being efficient with your breathing, but also the lack of tension so everything can be like Renee Fleming would say, you know, you have to have that resonance in your head.
Do you think your teaching has changed over the years?
I would hope so. I always, you know, I think students bring in a lot of new things, and different students from different areas of the country bring in different concepts, and you can add or take away or see what you can do to change. I'm still kind of old-fashioned, that there are certain books that all of my students have to get through. You know, I don't care what they've done in the past, but mainly because I've been teaching a long time, and I unfortunately see people that are in the professional role that have come to me to get some help because they're having some chop stuff, and I'm like, well, did you do these books? No. And I think, and that's why I'm such a stickler, not making students just play excerpts, because I feel that they've learned how to play the instrument through excerpts instead of learn the instrument through etude books and solos and then put those excerpts on top.
To me, that has to do with what you were saying early on about when you were on the farm, about learning patience and playing the long game and having the fundamentals.
Right.
And developing that over a long period of time. Do you, this is a question I ask quite often because it's interesting to me. When a new student comes in, is there a certain type of student that you can tell this person's really going to do great or is going to turn into a great player? Is there a certain mentality or the way they view things? And I'm not necessarily talking about like if a student is really gifted in terms of embouchure or something like that.
No, I think some students that come in to me that are like, you would call them green, are really the fun people to because they haven't experienced some of the music, so they don't have an opinion. And it's really fun when they open up their eyes and go, wow, that is so beautiful, or that's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's when it's really fun. And not to have someone that is already having some mental stuff because they're thinking about things instead of just being open for new ideas. Yeah, you can tell when people have the talent. It's not the talent, as we all know. It's what's past that talent is the work. Are they willing to do that work?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are talented, but it's not just that anymore. It's like that book, that talent is overrated.
Yes. Yeah, it's a good book.
It goes back to the farm, you know. I always say, being able to fail is okay. And then students would say, yeah, right, you failed, right? I said, oh, yeah. I mean, I had this calf. Oh, my dad gave me this calf, and it was like, it didn't have any dirt on it. I washed it. I brushed it. It was beautiful. It would shine. I could lead it. It would do everything I asked it to, put its feet in the right place, and it had a bad rump, and I got a yellow ribbon. I didn't win. You have to do it all over again. There's only so much you can control, and it's the work that comes into it, you know?
I almost feel that if you're not failing, you're not challenging yourself enough.
I think so, too. I really do think so. I think that you learn from mistakes. I have to laugh at it. I know somebody that is a really great player, and they went to the wrong Columbus. It's not Georgia, it's Ohio. I hope they learn from their mistake. But it's not so much that, but it's you have to learn from mistakes to grow. I mean, that's, you look at any athlete and they're going to strike out or they're going to miss a free throw. And musicians have to keep trying the same thing. And I always say, you know, if I had a batting average that was only 313, I would have never gotten a job. And I'm never going to get paid what those guys get paid. You know? But you have to have the opportunity to practice failing so you can continue going forward.
Well, boy, this has been fun. It's great having you on. And do you have anything else you'd like to say?
No, I just sit here and remember so many fun things. And I have to say thank you to you, because not only did we have many laughs and we played your wonderful music and I got to sit next to you and giggle with you in rehearsals and performances, but you also opened up my eyes to many different books. So on tours, we would go to a bookstore, and I think you had me buy Frankenstein one time.
Did I really? Okay. That's yes. A wonderful book. I mean,
it is a wonderful
really
book.
Yeah. It's really different from the movies. Actually, there's a right now I'm working intensely on an opera about Caroline Herschel, who was the first woman astronomer. And there's a book called The Age of Wonder, and I forget the name of the author, but it's about all these scientists during the time of Mary Shelley and Lord Byron and all of that, and how all these people knew each other and were interrelated and all of that. And she discovered a number of comets. Her brother discovered the planet Uranus. So, I mean, they're really top people, but they also knew people like Mary Shelley and how all this sort of romanticism combined. It's a very interesting time, very interesting period. But yeah, anyway, going to the bookstores, that's still fun. I mean, that's really great. But they have, the bookstores in America are far, well, what used to be bookstores in America. I don't know if you have them
anymore.
Thank
you. I'm glad you said that, because it's very sad.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, you mentioned Renee Fleming. And the person who supposedly helped her write the book was Ann Patchett. And her novel, Bel Canto, is supposedly about Renee Fleming, where Renee Fleming is the singer in that book. Yeah, that's what I've heard. But Ann Patchett lives in Nashville and writes in Nashville. But she started an independent bookstore that's doing really well.
Wow.
So it is possible to survive.
So she must know your friend Ron.
She doesn't, actually, although Ron took me to the bookstore and she knows everybody. So they have these evenings with authors, you know, where one author will interview another. And I mean, they just have great people. I mean, really top people. So, but anyway, she's, I don't know how that came up. I forgot how.
Yeah, I like her.
My train of thought right now, but yeah. Okay, well. We'll be in touch. And thanks so much for the time. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Yeah, it's really great to see you, Tony.